Welcome to the Fresh Heart Project. This is a special conversation. Emily Hodge is a coach, a mum, a wife, an entrepreneur, and an author who shares her journey with us. Emily was newly married when she found out the devastating news that she had bowel cancer. Overnight, her life changed. She talks to me about her journey with bowel cancer, the impact it had on her fertility, her grief, and also how she came through it to build her family and the business that she has today. I was very moved by Emily's journey and incredibly inspired by her spirit. This conversation was recorded in November 2021, and as a quick update, Emily's book has not yet been released, but I, for one, cannot wait for when it's out. I warn you, this conversation is heavy, but I guarantee you that it ends on such a hopeful and beautiful note. You may need to listen to it in parts, but I do recommend that you continue to the end. So Emily, thank you so much for coming here and joining us, sharing your story on the Fresh Heart Project. I'm so grateful that you've agreed to share your story. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, I'd like to start by saying that, you know, it's a fact, you're amazing. And I'm so grateful that you're here sharing your story. Now, you're a mum, you've got your own coaching business, you're a coach, but you're also an author. And I read that you did the first draft of your book in just 6 weeks. Firstly, wow, how did you manage that in 6 weeks? And secondly, what's your book on?
A really good point. How did I manage that in 6 weeks? I made sure that I was really kind to myself in the process. I knew I had this target. I knew I wanted to get the first draft done in 6 weeks. And so instead of trying to clear loads of space or set a whole week writing, which I know wouldn't have been possible, instead of trying to get up really early or write into the wee hours when I really need my sleep, I instead just actually took away quite a few things like social media, but also just took away white space. So I had about an hour and a half, three times a week on average, and wrote in 20-minute stints within that time. That was really good for my mental health as well. It meant that I felt like I could sit and concentrate for 20 minutes and then have a rest and then concentrate again. It also meant I didn't put too much pressure on myself to kind of, you know, you must write for 3 hours and you must produce X number of words. I took that away. But in the end, I actually did produce that number of words anyway. So yeah, it was really, really good. It is only the first draft, but I kind of minimize it by saying that. I guess a lot of people wouldn't have got to the first draft at that point.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think what I love about it is that you were kind to yourself, and that, you know, sometimes there is unrealistic expectations on producing something that you have to wake up really early or you have to just carve out time when you don't have that time. So I love the way that you did it. And what is the book on?
Well, its current title is Gentle: How to Lead Your Business with Ease and Flow in a Hustle-Based World.
Ooh.
Yeah, I am very excited by it. I guess that title might change as I sort of edit and send it to people and get feedback, but that's essentially the premise of the book. So bringing in compassion and kindness to when you do your business, when you run your own thing, and making sure that you have certain things in place so that you can do it successfully but without burning out.
I love it, and I can't wait to read it.
Thank you.
Very excited.
Spring 2022, I hope.
That's the date. That's the date to look out for. Yes. Now, what for you is, you know, you're a coach, and you have quite a few coaching clients. What's the best thing for you about being a coach?
I think there's two things mainly. The way that when you connect with a client and the rapport that you can build with them. And actually, I would say it's not about building rapport. You just have it. You often just have it. And it's the easiest thing in the world, but you're transforming a life. And that feels really powerful. And sometimes I don't take the opportunity to reflect on that. I have supervision and I do journal writing and things on it, but you just still forget that what you're doing when you genuinely support someone in a really amazing way is that you're changing their life. Because I was the same, right? I was a coaching client before I became a coach, and I had the same thing. And I still do to some extent. I still have coaches who help me. So I still feel that sense of what it's like to be transformed. Yeah. I love that part. When you, you know, see someone's eyes and they're like, I can do this. I can do this differently. I can be someone else, or I can make more money, or I can have success and balance. They're all possible. Yeah. That's one side of it. The other side of it is, I would say, a bit more ego driven. And I would used to have said that was a negative thing. And now I'm like, no, no, it's great. It's a good ego, which is about having a form of status, I think, feeling secure and empowered in my own business and running my own business. I love it. I now don't think I could be anywhere else. I couldn't be back in an office. And I say that because I'm not in one, but I work really well on my own. you know, creating ideas and then coming up with stuff and marketing, I quite enjoy. So that side of it is brilliant as well.
Oh, it sounds like you are exactly where you need to be.
Oh, thanks.
It really does. I could sense the energy coming from you when you were talking about it. So it's really lovely to hear. And now what I'm going to sort of slightly change track a little bit is to talk about your background and where you came from and your journey. And I want to take you back to your wedding day. Can you tell me how you were feeling on your wedding day and a little bit about that?
Oh, I was nervous. I didn't think I would be. I didn't know that I was going to. When you walk up the aisle, we had quite a traditional church wedding in a little village. But I was walking up the aisle and I realised I was smiling, but my lip was like, yeah, because not crying, but like, oh, I'm nervous, because everyone sort of looks around at you, don't they, when you're walking up. I didn't realize I was going to be nervous, but I was. But I loved it. It was such a great day. We had, oh gosh, how many people, like 100 people, I think. We had a marquee in an old house, partied with my husband's friends who are musicians, and they played for us. Oh gosh, yeah, it was really nice. It was in the countryside, which is just where we love as well.
It sounds wonderful and idyllic. And when, you know, you have these big occasions in life, you always think about the future and you think about your hopes and aspirations. Did you have that at that point in time? Did you think of any, you know, where you thought you were headed at that point?
Yeah, we'd started to have conversations. We lived in London at the time and we started to have conversations about moving out. But it hadn't really planned. I definitely hadn't planned it and hadn't envisioned when it would be. I can't remember if we'd actively had a conversation about when we might like to try for children, but I know that we'd sort of said maybe in a few years. So that was all on the cards, but we hadn't sort of said by this year we'll be here. But it was definitely part of the conversation, you know. I knew we wanted a dog as well.
Very important.
Important.
And from a career perspective, did you know where you were headed? Did you think you know where you were headed?
I did, actually. I was in the NHS. I was working in public health. I loved it. I just graduated? I think I'd just finished my master's. So it was all a bit of a cusp of a moment of, gosh, now I can celebrate by having the wedding and also saying I'm moving into another part of my life. Worked in London. I really enjoyed the team I was working with. Yeah, I was definitely on a track, I guess you could say, around moving up into, I don't know whether I would have ever have moved into what would have been the senior position, like public health lead and all those kind of things. But I was in that world and I don't think I saw that I wouldn't be in it at that point.
Yeah. And then was it a few weeks or a few months later that your life overnight changed?
Yeah. So the wedding was in May. We went on a mini moon, I guess it's called, to, gosh, where was it? In the UK. Went away for a week in a shepherd's hut. And it was really cool. There were little sheepdogs owned by the people and we hung out with them all week. That was around August time. We came back and then Dom had his birthday, which is in late August. Yeah. And then by September, I found out I was pregnant, which was really cool. Didn't really expect it to happen, but it happened. And it was really exciting. I wasn't very well at all. I had been really sick. But I remember going to the doctor and the doctor saying, pregnancy isn't an illness. We just need to make sure that you're okay. But I did keep getting more sick. And in that process, I had also realised that I'd started to have blood in my poo. Right. But it's really hard because I was going through pregnancy, I was a bit like, there's all these other changes going on. I don't really know. And also you Google that and people say, oh, it's quite normal. It's piles or whatever. So I think I eventually went to my GP and to talk specifically about it. And I remember going to talk about the sickness as well. And so he sorted out the sickness. And then the GP said, oh, I might just refer you just in case. It was very much a off the cuff, like just because you're asking about it. And I got a referral to a local hospital in London quite quickly. And about a week later, I went to that referral.
That's quick.
Yeah, but I think it was because I was pregnant. Right. I think that they, either the GP started to have like an idea of what was going on, or they just went, she's pregnant, so we need to kind of think about her health around that as well. I'm not really sure, actually. But went to the hospital, totally just expecting to walk in and have, I think I was expecting either a scan or a something. It was a very non, it was an outpatient appointment. I don't think I told anyone. Dom knew I was going, but he was at work. No need to think about it. And that's honestly where it really very quickly became clear that this wasn't just an outpatient appointment and stuff was gonna change.
And when were you actually told what happened around that?
Well, in the appointment, I ended up going to a, it was a bowel surgeon, but they did a sigmoidoscopy. So it's a procedure where they look up the first part of your bowel, like the first 10 inches, I think it is. So they can do it without any, without you needing to go under. Yeah. So they did that. And I remember thinking, okay, that's quite, it's a procedure still. Yeah. And it's so interesting. The guy walked out the room and said, I'm just going to, there was a nurse with me and he walked out the room and he said, I'm just going to go and get a colleague. I'll be back. And the nurse put her hand on my shoulder and she went, are you okay, Emily? Are you all right? And literally that was the minute I was like, I'm okay. Is this okay? Mm-hmm. And I don't really remember what she said back, but then he came in with his colleague.
Right.
And, some of that's a bit of a blur, but I do remember them moving me to another room and then saying, is your husband available? I think we need to go and get him.
And he was at work.
He was at work and that was hideous. I was like, now you're really worrying me. Yeah. What's going on?
Yeah.
So I walked outside. We must have had mobile phones then. It was 2010. I remember calling his phone, didn't answer. I can't remember how I then got, I think I phoned some friends, but didn't really say anything. But then I remember phoning his office for them to phone the person whose office he was in to get him out of his meeting and tell him to come and find me. So that was all very like the poor guy hearing that he needed to get in a taxi and go across London because your wife's in hospital. And anyway, they still didn't tell me anything, but they said they needed to get me in for another procedure. Yeah. So that same day I was waiting in the waiting room and they got me back in for a full endoscopy, I guess it's called. And during that I saw the cancer tumour that they found.
And that was in your colon?
It was in my colon, quite low down. So it's still quite near my anus, I guess. Yeah. And that was what was really tricky is they were, the position of where it was is what led to lots of the reasons why I needed the procedure I then went on to have. Yeah. And then what they found subsequently as well, which was not just a tumour, but multiple polyps. Right. But I still didn't know at that point if it was cancer or not. Mm. But I had asked the surgeon or the person doing it. I said something like, at this point, it all been going through my mind. Like, what is this? What's happening? I don't understand. But when they showed, when I saw the tumour, I then understood it was a tumour, it was a something, it was a growth. And I said, how often in cases like this is this cancer? Yeah. And she said something like, it isn't always cancer.
And you knew.
Oh, it was just like, what? Just a complete out of body experience of like, I can't believe this, but I also can't believe you're not telling me. I can't, They then told me, they then assigned me a sort of cancer nurse quite quickly. That tells you something. Mm. And I just remember about 3 days later, I went to the cinema with Dom because I just by this point was beside myself. I turned my phone off, came out of the cinema, turned it back on. And I'd already said, please don't keep me waiting. Like, I cannot have you tell me that you're going to pull me in for an appointment in 3 days and me wait for 3 days. The minute you know, I give you permission to tell me over the phone because I have to know. And they said, are you with your husband? Are you at home? And I think at this point I was. And they were like, yes, it's confirmed that it's cancer. We need to do these tests, which was, you know, 10 or so things to find out what stage it is, where it's positioned, where else it might be. So that's sort of, yeah, that's where it all started, I guess.
Yeah. And I guess for you, you spoke to me when we had a chat earlier about being on a railway track and you're on one particular route and you think that's where you're going to go. And then you get this total sense of derailment. Can you tell us a little bit about that, that feeling of derailment?
Yeah, I mean, I think I obviously this is now 10 years ago, so I've had a lot of time to reflect on that particular period of days. I still don't quite know how I felt, but I think when I remember it, I went into a form of shock. I'm pretty sure I did, because you just don't know what's going to happen. And I remember doing a lot. I remember I've since found the notebooks that I wrote stuff in about who to call and what I needed to remember and the person's name and the number and stuff. And I think at that point, you don't know that you're going to be shoved off this track, but you're very quickly in a put into a medical format that you know the medics kind of know, but you have no idea as the patient what to expect. The track analogy came up again and again and again, and probably mostly even 4, 5, 6 years later, when I then went on to, you know, think about fertility and babies, the track became even more apparent. Actually, I would probably say it started to become apparent then when you realize there's no one around me who's going through this. I can't find another 30-year-old who is experiencing this right now, and another 30-year-old who's going through bowel cancer, which is what it turned out to be. So I subsequently found those people, but in that moment, it felt very, very isolating.
And very lonely.
Yeah, and confusing, and I don't know if I started to feel angry then. I had anger later, but it was confusing. It was so much confusion because they still hadn't been able to say to me, the baby's going to be okay or not, or we think we can do this or not. And I still didn't know if I needed surgery or whether I was going to have chemo, or just was so, yeah.
And then really sadly and tragically, you lost the baby, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. And that was a whole other part of, you know, grieving and expectation that you hope that is going to be and happen. But yeah, it wasn't to be. And I think in a way it kind of made conversations around what was going to happen worse and easier. But it was so frantic. The whole thing felt frantic, and I don't remember, I don't remember whether I slept or ate, or I must have gotten around to telling friends at that point, but I can't remember much about it. That's probably shock, I think. You know, and at that point, it's so early days that people's reactions can change also. I remember 3 years later, people telling me, I remember when you told me, or I remember when Dom phoned me and told me. So the pregnancy didn't last. And as a result of that, it almost then put us into this other box of, well, what do we do about your fertility? Right. If we need to have the surgery that we think we're going towards, we need to protect your fertility in case anything happens. Yeah. So it was all just so, like, one day you're sort of pregnant and expecting a baby and talking to your work about maybe going off on maternity leave. And then 2 days later, you've got cancer, and a week later you're no longer pregnant and you're talking about a major surgery that's going to change your whole life. It's, yeah.
Goodness, I am so sorry, Emily. It sounds really awful and traumatic. And, you know, it's a testament to you that you're here sharing your story so that, you know, anyone else going through this can feel less isolated and alone. Yeah. And you were still working, weren't you?
Yeah.
What were you doing, and how was the reaction at work? Did it help? Did it not help? What was going on around that?
I had some really good friends at work at the time, and actually I've still know, you know, quite a few of them now. So that was helpful because I remember, I'm sure I must have told them personally, or, you know, somehow told them, rather than just going to HR and saying, this has happened, or my manager and saying, this has happened. I was friends with my manager as well, though. I remember some funny reactions. I can laugh about it now. So my friends knew, and then I'd started to understand that there was going to probably be a surgery, and I would, you know, I had cancer and I needed some time off, whatever that looked like. I was in the NHS, which is an incredible sickness policy. So the minute I said, I have cancer and I need time off, without even knowing what I needed to have done, it was completely, you know, acceptable and it went through. I do remember, though, not long after, this is probably a week or so after the diagnosis, or maybe after losing the baby, I remember logging in to my account, and there was a very weird email from like the team VA that said, literally to all, me included, Emily has cancer, she'll no longer be at work for the foreseeable future.
Wow.
It was like, what?
Wow.
What? Like, this is the weirdest message I've ever read, and it's about me. It would be weird if it was about someone else, but it's about me. I honestly don't remember doing anything about it. I don't think I like complained. It was just, this is so weird. I need to go.
It's a shock, isn't it? It's quite like just matter of fact, compassionless, cold almost.
Yeah, and I'm sure they didn't mean it as a person. It just was, this is, and also I'm sure now, I mean, there's stuff like confidentiality. What if I hadn't wanted anyone to know? I don't remember having any of those conversations. Yeah. I do remember my boss and my friends at work being incredibly lovely. I remember people writing a lovely card. And I think for the most part, people were very good about not asking too many questions. Because at that point, when you're suddenly thrown into this place, you have all the questions. So other people asking you them is really hard. And I do remember being very short with some friends around, like, I haven't got energy or space for your questions. And some later on, I do also remember being very clear that I haven't got energy or space for your needs in all of this. Some of that sort of resilience doesn't come until later when you're quite worn down and realizing you have to keep yourself protected.
Absolutely. And people can do things and say things with the best will in the world, and they want to know and help and be kind, and sometimes you just have to say, don't you, that actually it's too much.
For sure. And I think, unfortunately, that also contributed to quite a few breakdowns of relationships. People's feelings being hurt, which absolutely makes sense, but you really are, for me, it was the first time in my life that I'd ever had to consider, what do I literally need? Like, what is the only thing I need, which is like protection? And to do that, to actively turn people away, is quite difficult. But I've since discovered through talking to lots of other cancer patients, you know, friendships and relationships are one of the most complicated things that you go through in it, because you're no longer on the same track as all these other people. Now, there's an advantage to that. You're sort of taken off and you're unique, let's say, but it's not one of your choosing. It's not because you've chosen to be like very different. It's because you stand out like a sore thumb because you're a 30-year-old with cancer. So,
and it's hard, isn't it? Because people, again, talking about the best will in the world and with the best intentions, you were told quite a lot to be positive, weren't you?
Yeah.
And I'm sure people said that with, you know, trying to give you a bit of positivity, but it's not always received that way, is it? It's quite harsh.
It was never received well, I have to say. And this is what I struggled with a lot, to the point where it is very much the reason why I've developed the coaching brand, I guess, that I have, which is, instead of trying to be positive, like, be accepting of whatever you're in, and then we can move you through the feeling without it being forced away. And that came really from early days of cancer, which some people were amazing, no doubt about it, and plenty of people were great and good, but a proportion of people were without always meaning to be. And sometimes there was a tiny proportion who just weren't grey at all. But it's just they were accidentally just blurted stuff out. And often the, oh, you know, as soon as you sort of start telling information, oh, but it's not terminal. Oh, that's great, isn't it? So yeah, it's great, but it's still happening. And oh, but you're, oh, great, so you're going to have surgery, so it'll all be gone. Yeah, but the surgery is life-changing and it's really difficult. Oh, great, you only need 4 rounds of chemo. Yeah, but I need chemo. Like, it would always be people minimising the situation because they needed to and because it helped them and because they want you to feel okay without leaving space for going, how do you feel about that? And what, you know, why do you wonder why I became a coach? Like, what do you that sounds good. Is that what you think too? It, again, it's not their fault, but it's very hard not to internalize that. And what happens is when people make it positive, you feel bad as a patient for actually either trying to put them right, which is you let's I guess go to the base of this, which is you want to be positive, you want to feel okay, you want to be zen about the whole thing, but quite frankly you're not. And I was pissed off, I was angry at this point. I'd gotten angry because it was like, this is massive. I also had started to grieve I should be on maternity leave, or this was sort of a bit later, but you know, thinking I should be pregnant. So anytime someone tried to make it positive without me first being positive was like, no, that's not where I'm at right now. So it was a very early way of me being able to find that acceptance of my feelings. And it's a reason why I did then seek out quite a lot of cancer patients to talk to, because inevitably it's a huge experience that you want to talk to other people about. But also, does anyone else feel like this? Like, why do I feel like an awful person for telling people, like the dichotomy of saying to people, actually it's not as positive as you think it is, but it is also okay. It's like, why am I having to do the looking after people's emotions? I don't need to be doing that.
And were there people who were very helpful? What did they do and how did they show up?
Yeah, thinking about it now, there's friends who I had at the time who I was close to, but sort of not always super close to, and the way that they acted and the things they did or the things they said became so amazing. You know, I became much closer to them. There's other people who were very close in my life who some of them I no longer speak to. Over the years, things have happened as well that probably started around then. Certain, like friends, some friends were still traveling or away. I had a friend in Australia, but she literally wrote me handwritten letters almost weekly at one point. I know, and just beautiful stuff. I had other people send books just because it was just thoughtful. And I guess one of the biggest things was friends who were able to just go, how are you feeling? Do you want to talk? And I would say I've got a really healthy, quite a large friendship group, but I would say there was probably only two or three people that I did that with who offered it in that way and who provided that time. And remember, it's a time when it also they were busy, like two of them were going off to have babies as well. One of them was sort of starting an international job. So it wasn't like they had nothing going on in their life. They were able to support me and also my husband. They reached out to him and helped him a lot too.
Well, I'm so pleased that you had them in your life. And I'm so pleased that they showed up in the way that you needed them to, because that does make a difference, doesn't it?
Huge difference. Yeah. And you remember that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And you ultimately did, you know, get over the bowel cancer. The bowel cancer was treated and it was treated successfully. Mm. Tell me about that period in your life.
Yeah. So probably I had surgery, I had chemo, and a year or so later, I had a stoma that was reversed. So all of that took about 18 months in total. Then I was technically, I guess I was clear actually the minute I had surgery, but you know, you move into like a period of 3 to 5 years where you're being monitored. So whilst there was no longer cancer, that was really when I started to understand the scars that were present. So I guess that was when I started to really look at what was happening in my life and how I felt about everything. And I started to properly grieve. It was a case of now things are calmed down, everything else is overwhelming. It's like you have no longer all these appointments that you have to remember and all these people that you need to speak to. You're left alone to kind of get on with your life. And it's really when you're like, what on earth has just happened? I know I've been living it, but I don't really know how it's happened and what's happened. And ultimately, it's where a lot of decisions were made. Dom and I moved from London to Surrey. I don't think we'd gotten the dog by then, but we definitely had been on the road. I had a cat at this point. We got another cat because I volunteered at a rescue centre. I did go back to my job. I actually had about 18 months off my work, which is quite a long sickness time. But ultimately, I left because it just wasn't the right place. I would have been commuting, so that was one thing, but I just couldn't. Mentally, I couldn't get my head around being in an office with people who had known me pre-cancer, and I was now this new but same person, two sides. And I also I was working in public health, so doing a lot of health prevention stuff. There was bowel cancer awareness and sort of like sheets in front of me. I was like, this doesn't feel quite right. So ultimately, I left my NHS position as well. But that did take quite a lot of...
Was that an easy decision or was it? Yeah.
No, not at all. Yeah. Because especially if you're on a version of a sort of management position or expecting to go up and, you know, amazing pension, amazing maternity leave in the NHS, all of that stuff. But none of that mattered because my health was vital. And, you know, I knew my health was vital, but it was more like, I can't cope. I actually can't cope being here. It was too traumatic to be in a space where I felt just that I no longer belonged. I felt profoundly changed and it felt odd to be in an office. I must have gone in. Must have gone back because I do remember the new office that we'd also moved to.
Right.
And I remember having a conversation with my manager about potentially working part-time. It was actually denied, which I'm not sure is actually legal now, but I don't think I could have worked part-time and I couldn't have worked from home at the time.
Part-time often means full-time anyway, doesn't
it?
That's
sort of. I just remember it being the option was like 4 days a week, which is really no different. It was just like, I don't know what I'm yet going to do. I don't know that this is exactly the right career decision, but I have to go because this is very, very difficult for my health now. So,
yeah. And was there something about listening to that inner voice, listening to your intuition at that point in time?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I think I quashed it down because I remember being off sick when I was like physically away from all the treatment, but not well enough to be back. So I managed to be getting myself a bit more healthy and putting weight back on and...
Yeah.
I remember thinking, I've got to go back to work. I know I'm going back. I'm kind of excited, but I'm also nervous. Probably it started then, but you don't know until you experience it. And then I remember agonising over the decision for longer than weeks. It really shouldn't have been longer than weeks, but it was. And I remember Dom had just got a new position in his job. So financially, we weren't going to be covered, but we would be safe. And it was just a case of, we have to make this decision. You can't. I was going to be really unhealthy if I'd have stayed, basically.
Yeah. How quickly after that did you then start to think about trying for another baby?
Yeah, we'd probably been thinking about it for a long time. It had been the biggest mental challenge that I'd been through during the whole cancer.
Mm.
Other than like being in pain and managing all of that, I'd always in the back of my mind thought, just get to a point where you can get well again and then you can think about having a baby. So it had been a bit of a driving force during the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then about a year or so, maybe two after my last surgery, when I'd started to be healthy again, I think I'd started to have periods again because I lost them during, I was so underweight and also the chemo had stopped them. Started to have periods, my fertility looked like it was back. So we pretty much started trying then and quite quickly realised that it may not happen. And within a year or so, I'd been referred to like an IVF clinic, mostly because they had said, I think they'd given us like 9 months because they said, if you've had chemo and you've had surgery, we need to be a bit quicker with it rather than wait 2 years or whatever the normal dates are. So yeah, quite quickly, I would say we were trying and then realised we might need some help.
When did you start thinking about IVF?
So pretty much around a year or so after we'd been trying. They had said, come to us, you know, if it's before a year and you haven't gotten pregnant. And I, at this point, was, I wasn't worried. I thought, I don't exactly remember, but I remember thinking this will be possible. I had fertility before. I got pregnant so quickly, you know. And also we managed to, I say managed, within the space of no longer being pregnant and my big surgery in 2010, there were 3 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks maybe. So they had put me in for a really quick round of IVF to get any embryos or eggs and then make them into embryos, Dom sperm, to store them in case I had no fertility. So that was always in the back of my mind, like we've always got them. Yeah. But, you know, in my mind, I just thought, of course we're going to get pregnant. Of course we are. Nothing, that wouldn't happen. I mean, somewhere in my brain, it was probably a, you're not due that much bad luck, but that's just such an awful phrase and I hate it. So I'm not sure why I ever thought that. Anyway, we ended up starting IVF. I think it was in, it must have been in Surrey at this point because we were down here. And yeah, I did 3 fresh rounds of IVF, which is essentially where they stimulate you to get your eggs. And I always had quite a lot of eggs. They always had shown me like good progress on the charts. I'd responded quite well to the drugs. There wasn't really anything during that process to tell me this isn't going to work. And I also knew that I'd had a pregnancy. Dom's sperm had been checked and it was like super sperm. So it was always like a really nice, oh, this is okay. But yeah, I didn't get pregnant twice and I got pregnant on the third one, or it might have been the other way around, but I did have a pregnancy and that was amazing. That felt like, gosh, this is sort of turning around, and this means that if I can get pregnant now, then I can get pregnant again. And, you know, and we didn't even use our embryos, yay, and all those things. And then as it turns out, that pregnancy wasn't viable. So
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, thank you.
And what happened after
It was all really, I remember that more clearly, not only because it was more recently, or I say more recently, it was 2016, I think, but also it was so odd. It was so odd. And that's where I mentioned earlier about anger. It's really where I felt myself becoming a different person. I felt, we went up to Harley Street to have an early scan because I think we'd wanted to also know the gender just because. So the early scan had been about 10 or 11 weeks. And we'd had scans with the IVF clinic and nothing had showed up abnormal. So we were in Harley Street. And the way that the sonographer responded to us, I was lying on the bed and I remember she said, I'm just going to go and get my colleague. And of course my brain went, wait a minute. Heard that before. Mm. And I remember holding Dom's hand and being like, oh God, something's not right. And he was like, no, it's all fine. And I brought the second sonographer in, which was quite an older guy. And just really quickly, they basically explained that the fetus wasn't viable and it had a condition that they'd never seen before. This is Harley Street that scans probably hundreds of people a day. And so I broke down. I was inconsolable. I couldn't leave the room for about 2 hours. I remember we walked around Regent's Park, just in shock. Very quickly, they had phoned our hospital down here to get us referred in. So we took the train back, went to Surrey Hospital, and it all, just was this very strange few days of, again, a load of decisions that weren't really decisions. It's this fetus will die if we allow you to carry on. We had another pregnancy loss. That was the worst. That was like just felt Yeah, I don't know. I could feel myself slightly slipping away from reality. I was a bit like, I just don't think this is happening. This cannot be happening. This isn't possible. Yeah. And that's when, and saying it now, I don't think it sounds odd, but I really didn't feel that life was fair. Yeah. And yet now I can see there's so much privilege to what I had happen as well. I had the privilege of being able to have IVF. I had the privilege of giving up my job when my husband could help me. I understand all that, but it doesn't take away the trauma and
The pain.
Yeah, and the loss. And
how much had you banked on that pregnancy when you got that positive pregnancy test?
I mean, clearly a lot, which I probably hadn't realised until I lost it. It felt like this is where life changes. This is where luck starts to change. And just a horrible phrase, really. I just felt like this is the moment that all of that stuff goes. And then it didn't. And it didn't work out. And it was like, I don't know. I can't figure the world out now. I was in a position at my work at that point. I was working at Macmillan Cancer Support, which is quite a stressful job. It was a great position, but quite stressful. And I just was like, no, I can't function. I actively went into trauma, I think, for about 3 months. Yeah. I just barely even talking about it now. I can just don't remember now what I did.
And do you think that was the point where you reached your low point?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I don't really remember like thinking I need to plan something. Yeah. I can't. I went a bit blank. It was like, I can't figure this stuff out. Yeah. I don't remember feeling like life. I was never, ever suicidal, and I never had any thoughts about, suicide, but I definitely was at a moment of, I don't know why I'm alive. I don't really understand, because I can't figure out why I need to keep going through this stuff. Yeah. I know it's not selfish, but it feels selfish because Dom was going through all this stuff too. And we ended up supporting each other a lot because we'd been through the experience together. But yeah, I in the back of my mind, I knew I needed to go through this period of nothingness and grieving, like the ultimate grief, because I probably held on the whole time during cancer. Just get pregnant. Just have a baby and this will all go.
It will be okay.
Yeah, which is such a shame, really. Yeah. But it makes sense. And then I couldn't, and we'd lost a pregnancy, and it was like, this just, no, I've got nothing to, I just don't know what I'm holding on to anymore.
How did you rebuild yourself after that?
I remember going to, so I was down in Surrey, and my friend had a membership at a really lovely spa, like a gym and a spa. And I would go sometimes with her in the years before to spend a day there, like she could get me on her ticket. And I joined there because I thought I just need to not only look after myself, I just need to just do something nice. And I went there almost every day, not to go to the gym, by the way, and get fit. It was literally, I need to go to the pool and sit in the sauna and just lie down. And I do remember that being one of the moments when I'd feel a bit of peace. Yeah. And to this day, saunas are a place where I feel incredibly like warm and obviously warm and cozy, but I get a lot of sleep when I go in a sauna. It's a place that I feel very drawn to. Honestly, that was one of the major things. Yeah. I had throughout the whole of the cancer experience had different counselling as well. I also got a counsellor at that point. I've had various sort of niches of counselling. Can't remember quite, I don't know if it's grief counselling then, but I definitely had support mentally. And I remember that was when I really started to think, I don't know what we're going to do about children. At some point, the only thing I can control in my life right now feels, other than like the really solids, which was my husband and my house and things, I felt like my career and the way I wanted to be in my work was the only thing I could really grab hold of. I wasn't quite ready as soon as it had all happened, but I knew that that's where I was going to be going.
And when you were basically taking time out for yourself, did you feel selfish?
Yes, but I did feel selfish. It was more, the selfish feeling came more from the need to now be talking about it all.
Really?
When, yeah, and I found that was when it was hard for other people because in their world, this stuff had already happened. Yeah, whereas I was going through like the multiple traumas, but also finally realizing I hadn't processed the cancer. I had been holding on so much to the pregnancy idea that I hadn't really processed the last 5 years. So then I needed to talk about it. And that's when life for other people who'd moved on, they'd had, not had their kids, but they were busy with their children. They were busy, you know, busy. We were all busy. And I felt, and that's, like I said, the anger side of it was tough because I felt jealous. I felt traumatized. Well, the trauma probably led to loads of other stuff, which I felt guilty for, which was jealous, angry, upset, sensitive, you know, all those things that we go through when you're going through grief.
And it's so important to feel those feelings, isn't it? Yeah. To have that process.
Yeah, yeah. And anger particularly is not a socially acceptable feeling. It's not an easy one for other people to be around. It's not an easy one to feel at all. You feel, especially if you're a relatively emotionally intelligent, kind person in general, it's like, why am I am so angry. This is not healthy. I don't like anything or anyone. Like, that doesn't feel nice. So there's a lot of processing, a lot of just, I'm going to have to go through this in order to feel safe and myself again.
Was there a point where you thought, right, now I think this may be a turning point. Now things, you know, I'm going to be okay. Was there that point?
There was quite a bit later, a very significant moment came. I would say that wasn't until about 2018, so 2 or 3 years later. Again, the dates are a bit hazy, which is probably quite helpful. I don't need to be remembering every date. But by this point, I had left my Macmillan job. I'd started my coaching training. I'd started volunteering with a charity in order to kind of build up my coaching hours. So career-wise, I had felt like this is really great. I'm really starting to get in line with where I want to go. Personally, I think I remember going through one more IVF and then ending it. But about a year or so after that, I went to a really lovely day sanctuary place in Surrey, and it has a silent day, and actually no one else was there. It wasn't like a bookable thing. You can just go and be silent for a whole day. And I went to that, took myself off to it. And I remember wanting to just write and feel like I could just write some stuff. And at this point, Dom and I were in discussions with each other about, shall we have children or not? Or can we or not? What are our options and where do we want to go? And that day, I remember just writing and writing and writing and crying a bit and sleeping on the grass. It was a warm summer-ish day. And I remember feeling that day, this sense of peace around, I don't know what's going to happen, particularly with children, but I think I'm going to be okay. I know. And it was like such a seminal moment. I know where I was when I thought that exact thought. I was looking out onto the Surrey Hills, and it was such a clear moment of peace. And for years I had said, during the cancer and 3-4 years later, I was still saying, all I want to feel is content. I don't have to feel super excited. I don't have to feel like anything, just content. Just give me contentment and I will be okay. And honestly, that day is the first day that I remember feeling genuinely content, and particularly content about the idea, I don't yet know if we're going to have children, but I think I'm going to be okay. And that has since stayed with me so much, because I still didn't know that point whether we were going to go on and have a child. I just thought, whatever happens, however it does or doesn't happen, I think I can manage. So, yeah, I mean, if you'd have told me in 2010 that it was going to take 8 years to get to that point, and then there's still another few years beyond it, I just would have gone, oh, that's hideous. But yeah.
That is so powerful. And I'm really pleased for you that you had that moment. And I have to admit, full disclosure, I did a bit of Instagram stalking. And it must have been around that time that you put this beautiful post up. And if it's okay with you, I'm going to read that paragraph that you wrote,
because
I loved it and I found it so emotional. And amazing. I'm going to read it because I think it kind of, it puts everything into context. Yeah. So you wrote, "Life is just one big way of learning, isn't it? It's managing in the big and small moments. It's finding peace even where it shouldn't be. It's being as truthful to ourselves and others as we can be. It's finding strength when we crumble. It's gaining a voice when we're muted. It's directing things so we feel a sense of control. It's failing and succeeding in the least obvious ways."
Oh gosh, that's lovely.
It's beautiful. You wrote that, Emily. It's so beautiful. Oh,
that's really nice.
Yeah. And you know, then you did go on to become a mother.
Oh yeah.
When did you then decide to opt for surrogacy as your method of becoming a mother?
I was just reflecting what it said about the directing so that we feel in control. That really resonates right now in answer to that question, because from that day a lot just became easier, because I and Dom could make decisions without trauma behind it. It was like, let's make a decision because it's right, not because we're running from something or desperate for something. And of course we were still desperate for a family, but it just had changed. Surrogacy had always been on the cards, and that's what's so interesting about this situation, is that because I'd had bowel cancer, I think it was pretty clear that my physiology might be different, but I was always told loads of people go on to have babies, you're young, etc., etc. But I had various people over the years go, "Do you know if you ever need a surrogate?" I mean, I think they were sort of joking, but so it'd always been part of the discussion, in case, because I've had 4 major abdominal surgeries, and you don't get really away from that with, you know, fertility the same anyway. So it wasn't out of the question that we'd all thought about it, but it'd always been so far-fetched and so like, yeah, but that's, you know, that's what American Kim Kardashian does. Well, at that point we didn't know that, but yeah, later. So we had been through other options of looking at children, and as in like how to have them, and decided that, if surrogacy would have been possible, then wouldn't that have been nice? Yeah. And then through a process of various discussions, so our brother-in-law has a friend who had done surrogacy in America, and I remember he had mentioned a few times over the years, you know, you should speak to this person. And it was always like, yeah, you know, either we won't need it, or later on, like, yeah, but it's so impossible. Like, hey, look how expensive it is. And eventually I thought, you know what, maybe just having a chat with her would be useful. And she was so kind and so open about the process. She'd had twins and had then since moved to Spain with them. And I remember just thinking, it's not impossible, but financially it's a huge stretch. And I knew America was the biggest stretch you could have, even though America legal process is probably the most protected. So I think we'd sort of slightly put it to bed, but we went on holiday to Scotland. And during the process of that, we often go walking, and we've got our dog by this point. We often go walking with a dog. And I just remember talking to Dom about, maybe we should just look into it. Maybe we should actually find out whether we're about to turn it down, when we haven't actually understood the exact budget, the exact process. And that honestly is what then led to it all snowballing. Because quite quickly when we got home, I phoned one of the agencies in the UK that support people to do it. We knew UK wasn't going to be the most easy, because there's quite a long waiting list. It's not illegal, but you're not legally covered on both sides. I knew America was going to be very expensive. Anyway, speaking to the agency, they all confirmed this, but I had happened to see on their website, they'd started talking about Canada. And I had happened to then just say, I've noticed that you're talking about Canada. What's the difference? And essentially, Canadian surrogacy system, as we're talking in 2021, this might be different even by next year, because UK's system is about to change. Canadian is almost like a mix of the UK and America. So it's still funded, but on a more of a, on a different sort of basis to America. And it's still, it's legal, which the UK isn't, but it's still done on altruism from some parts of it. So it was like, that sounds interesting. And it literally just went from there. That was, gosh, that must have been around like late 2018-ish. And then pretty quickly we got an agency in Canada. Dom was visiting New York for work, so I visited him there, and we went over to Toronto for a weekend, and we met one of the agencies. They matched us quite quickly with a surrogate. We matched quite quickly with a donor, because at this point I didn't have any eggs, and I couldn't go through IVF again, and I was now 40, whatever I was, 40 at that point. And honestly, that within 6 months, we had found our surrogate and we were pregnant with our now daughter.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
And what is your daughter's name? And why did you choose on that particular name?
Well, when I tell you her name, it might be quite obvious. She's called Hope. And we were in, so our surrogate is in Canada, and we ended up needing to go there for quite a long time because of COVID, which actually ended up being a massive blessing in disguise. Yeah. But during that process, we found out we were having a girl, so we started to do some names, and we just had a few names. But honestly, Hope came up, not actually because of the pandemic, even though it was sort of synonymous with it came up because it just felt so right. It felt really powerful, actually. It felt powerful. And we swapped her middle name with the name that she might have also been called, so Hope Evelyn Hodge. And it just suits her to a degree. It just suits her so much. We have, I think Hope Baby is a bit more common in America and Canada.
It's a beautiful name.
I just, honestly, it's just her.
Yeah.
She's just a hilarious, cheeky ray of sunshine. Yeah. And she just brings hope. So, yeah.
Oh, and do you feel hopeful? Do you feel hopeful about the future?
Yeah, it's such a good question to be asking, especially now. I think she's now nearly 18 months, you know, we're settling into parenthood, and throughout this whole journey of having her, so the last 18 months, it has been such an interesting time of going, now I'm a normal parent. Now, if I, not that I wouldn't tell anyone about the past, but you don't have to. And now it's just, I'm on the track of parenthood, like, oh, like, what do people think at the nursery gates? And, oh, have you started thinking about school? Like, those hilarious conversations that were so easy, but I probably felt 7, 8, 9 years ago and sooner, I couldn't be part of. And I didn't just have a baby just so I could be part of those conversations. It's just the everydayness of being a parent, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so hopeful because I can be more present. I can be absolutely more present and available. And I say no. I think I'm pretty safely saying no. I know I'm a better parent because of everything I've been through. I would say I'm a pretty chilled out parent. I wonder if I might be too chilled out and a bit like, she's fine. She's having a great time jumping on that thing. She won't hurt herself. I don't think I'd have been like that 10 years ago, 5 years ago. So I trust I'm the parent that Hope needs, which is lovely.
That is lovely. That is beautiful.
Yeah.
And Emily, if you could go back in time and tell your 30-year-old self just a bit of advice, what would you, now looking back, what would you tell Emily?
Oh Lord, what would I tell her? God, so much. Do you know, and I don't mean to be negative, it will become positive. I think, I don't know if I tell her it's going to take 10.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I tell her it's going to take 8 years to get to that moment where you felt clarity and contentment. I think that would have been a bit of a shock for her, because it just would have been too much. I would tell her that you can have the ability to feel content even during all of this. And your version of that does not have to look like anyone else's. I would tell her much sooner that she does not need to be positive for anyone else's gain. I would tell her that if she's angry, to feel it and not to worry about what other people think about that. I'd tell her to leave her job sooner. Yeah. apparently I tell her quite a lot. I wouldn't say like try and enjoy it. No, I would say don't worry when you don't, because it's okay not to.
Yeah. What are you excited about now for the future?
Oh my goodness. Well, do you know, such normal things I'm excited about. A friend of ours is having a big wedding anniversary celebration next year, and they've suggested we go away, like a big group of us with our children, on a sort of one of those like package holidays, but loads of people together. And I just am like, the idea of doing that is so normal and exciting, also because of COVID. Doing that, what am I excited about? I love going for a walk with Hope, who is just such a little scamperer, and she hangs out with our dog. They are like best friends. So walking with her in the sunshine is honestly the most beautiful thing I could be doing. It's lovely. And being not a better parent only because of her, but just because it also helps me to then work differently. It helps me to just live differently, knowing that she's around.
Emily, I'm so pleased that your journey has brought you here.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for being so generous and so open with your story. And may you genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, keep succeeding in the least obvious ways.
Thank you so much. I love that quote.
Thank you. Well, you wrote it. You wrote it. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you, Zarin.
What a conversation. I needed my box of tissues beside me for that one. I'm so grateful to Emily for being incredibly generous with her story. If you think somebody could benefit from this conversation, then please do share it. Thank you for tuning in.